So we have time for questions. Carl has a microphone, and if you would wait till he brings it to you, because we're recording this for our website and so forth, and if you'd hold the microphone horizontally, that will help with interference. How about the gentleman right up here? If you keep your, and please keep your comments to a question and indicate if there's one of the other judges you're addressing it to.
I don't know which judge, but I'm interested in knowing not who the serious suppliers of the drugs are. We've talked about suppliers and the big drug dealers. But who are the serious users of drugs in our society? I haven't heard any indication of where the money is coming from that's flowing in a Niagara to Columbia. Where does that originate? Is it coming from the street corners, or is it coming from the hills up in our affluent areas?
Well, I think the answer to that is yes. It is estimated, probably very conservatively, that there are 30 million people in our country that use illegal drugs on a regular basis. If any group uses or abuses drug more than any other in our society, because I think pretty well the standard is that every racial, every socioeconomic group uses these drugs pretty much on the same level. But if any group uses it more than any other, it's basically mine. It is Caucasian, upper middle class males that probably use drugs more than any other. And there's a phenomenal amount of money in this. The drugs are always in a society. There's never been a society, maybe other than the Eskimos that can't grow anything, that has never used mind-altering drug. It just has never happened. So the secret is, number one, to bring it back under control, because we have experienced a total collapse of the rule of law in this area. And number two, to take the profit out of it so that people don't have a vested interest in pushing it on our children and on the rest of us. So basically it is a problem that we have proved ourselves unable to incarcerate our way out of this problem. So let's try something different. But it's across the board.
Behind you.
I think of the war on drugs as very analogous to the Vietnam War, which was, in my judgment, a terrible mistake that the American people finally decided was a terrible mistake after many years of great suffering and great expense. And that came to an end mainly when the whole society woke up to the problem. But that was a problem that, for some reason or other, engaged everybody. My question is, how do you get this problem out of this room, where everybody's already converted, and get it in front of the nation and get everybody to understand it? Because I think when everybody does understand it, the solution is pretty obvious. We do something different. How do you get out of here and get to the American people?
I just ask questions, and Vaughn Walker has all the answers. If we knew that, we'd be doing it. This, in my view, is the ultimate of grassroots movements. There is so much bureaucracy. There is so much money, both legal and illegal, that is perpetuating the status quo, that we have an amazing situation in which the good guys and the bad guys have the same interests in perpetuating the status quo. So the only way we get around this is to get people, voters, taxpayers, aware in a grassroots movement. And I'm really optimistic. Who would have predicted that the Berlin Wall fell 2 years before it did? And I didn't hear anybody talking about that. I am convinced that this war on drugs will fall with the same rapidity that the Berlin Wall did. It's just a question of getting and legitimizing this discussion. And the best way we can do it is to talk on radio shows and talk in groups like this. So let's just keep at it. It's the best answer I have.
How about the gentleman in the back?
Thank you. you talked about legitimizing the debate on this issue, and one of the problems in doing that is that of those 30 million people who actually know the truth about drugs from personal experience, virtually all of them are afraid to speak up and tell their neighbors because they're afraid somebody like one of you will lock them in prison, will take away their home, right? Will get them fired from their job for merely telling the truth about their own experience. How can you as judges or we as citizens break that vicious cycle to let the truth come out?
Well, on this issue, the emperor has no clothes. And any time that you can expose the law enforcement machine that is driving these policies for what it really is, I think you don't have to preach to people because the answer is quite obvious. It's the same phenomenon that I tried to illustrate by the comment of Judge Snocky, that in a bank robbery case, the witnesses are nice people. If people were to see what drug prosecutions were, to watch them on court TV, or if Judge Judy were to preside at a drug trial rather than the sorts of things that she presides at, people's attitude about these cases might be altogether different. In fact, I think they would be different. And that would be a situation in which people who knew what was going on would be seen and would be telling their tale. And pretty soon, it would be obvious that it is not a question of a crusade. It's not a question of black and white, right and wrong.
There's a good friend of mine who is a federal judge in Orange County that teaches a class at the University of California at Irvine. And he talks about the drug war in this class. And he does something that is enormously creative in that. The first class, he brings over 10 recovering addicts to his class, and there are like 200 people in the class. He breaks them into 10 groups, and for an hour, he has these groups of students go out and talk with these drug-addicted people. And you know, these 200 students will never be the same because they will, for the rest of their lives, see this as a human issue instead of an incarceration issue. We need to humanize it. One of the Drug Policy Foundation conventions that they had brought in some recovering addicts, or some were not recovering, and made this a human thing. There is a fledgling movement going on today that actually have people introducing themselves by taking out ads in newspapers saying, "Hello, I am Dale and Betty. We are your neighbors and we smoke marijuana. And we are responsible people and we have this and we have that." That's a very legally dangerous thing to do. I acknowledge it. But we need to bring people accountable for their actions instead of what they put into their bodies. I'm your neighbor and I drink that glass of wine. You know, and it's pretty much the same thing. But you bring up an extremely difficult issue because legally it is very dangerous to do.
I'd like an opinion as to why the federal government hasn't mounted a stronger attack on the Proposition 215 clubs.
Why the federal government has not
launched a major attack on the Prop 215?
Well, they have. They've certainly taken the issue up in court. What do you mean, have not launched a stronger attack?
There are plenty of clubs that are open that are presumably operating in violation of federal law. So why haven't they moved in to shut them all down?
Well, I think it's perhaps what I was suggesting might be done with this kind of problem. Law enforcement ignoring it, rising above it. I think more and more you will see that sort of thing. I think we see it on a local level already to some degree. There, I think, will be places developing where people will be able to buy marijuana, and the police will know what's going on and they'll follow it. And after all, that's going to be a much more satisfactory outlet and source than the street corner. There will be some controls. There'll be some monitoring. There'll be some measures for quantification. And it's a far more satisfactory situation. So I would not view the perception that the federal government has not focused on the outlets for medical marijuana as a bad thing. It seems to me that's very much of a good thing.
Well, there is an ultimate reality here that those in the federal system know, except some of the senators, politicians, and that is that the federal criminal justice system is not equipped to do volume. They're just not equipped to do street crime. That's the state stuff. So they can bluster. You know, you hear General McCaffrey as the drug czar talking about we're going to do this and do that. But they do not have the ability to go in and handle things in volume. They are structured to attack the drug lords and the bigger things. So even though they don't like it, they are not equipped to be able to go in and prosecute them, fortunately.
How about the radio at the agreement?
Aside from foreigners and minorities in the 1960s, have either of you noticed more recently examples of how the government targets specific cultures or subcultures to stop the use of a specific drug?
Well, Native Americans is one.
Native Americans, David suggested. What do you have in mind?
For example, how they're dealing with increasing use of ecstasy, as far as all the publicity that's going on with the rave scene.
Increasing use of what?
Ecstasy.
You know, Judge Gray has an interesting observation about that in his book, and one that I must say I'd never thought of. And that is, let's assume that the federal government's interdiction policies were effective at stopping heroin and opiates and naturally created narcotics from coming into the country. What would happen? We'd see a tremendous increase in the production of methamphetamines and other synthetic drugs. There's always going to be a source for these drugs as long as there's any demand for them. And I think in many ways the synthetic drugs are more dangerous. They're less reliably quantified, and their potency is less reliably determined, and the production often takes place in circumstances that are highly dangerous, both to those who are involved and those who happen innocently to be in the neighborhood around. So the production of drugs is not going to stop until there is a diminution in the demand for those drugs.
One thing I might add is, as many of you may know, in countries like Peru, it's legal to have a cup of coca tea, and it's no more strong than a normal English cup of tea. And yet, if you were to bring a single tea bag of coca leaves back to the U.S., you'd hear about it. How about this gentleman right here? Just wait for them.
This is for both judges. Do you think there's a chance, given that we see some incipient resistance among the judiciary, you included, against the in this movement against the war on drugs, that we may get some progress like the Netherlands did, where the judiciary itself, without any legislation, did, in effect, legalize marijuana?
First of all, that is not my understanding of what happened in the Netherlands. I may be wrong, but that was a political decision that they made. The government instructed the police in the Netherlands in writing, as long as people stayed within general guidelines of quantity and quality, that they were instructed not to arrest them. I don't think that it can be and should not be a judicial decision. Like Judge Walker was saying, we did take an oath to follow the law. I tell my juries all of the time that they have numbers of options. If they do not agree with the law, they can run for Congress, they can support other legislators to change the law, they can pass another initiative. Their ability is not to decline to follow the law. Judges are required to follow the law. I do it, Judge Walker does it, and when we cannot do it, we should resign.
Hi. I've heard both of you. Yeah. You both have discussed, basically, it seems like your position is that, that the prosecution of the war on drugs is more negative than the benefits. But my position, and I want to know how you guys react to this, is how about the right of someone to use a psychoactive substance that's not alcohol? Of the 30 million, the estimate 30 million people who use drugs, I can tell you I know quite a few in places like my law school, Harvard Law School, where people are doing recreational cocaine and marijuana and ecstasy. And why should we not have a right to use those substances simply because they're not the predominant psychoactive substance used in this country?
Well, personally, I have no difficulty with that. I would not, however, want to run for public office on that platform. And I don't think anybody else would.
Gary Johnson.
Well, Gary Johnson, you mean, in New Mexico?
Wait until the second term.
Exactly. You know, it's a lot easier to talk about these issues when you have life tenure than when you have to face the electorate every 2 years or 6 years, or in Judge Gray's case, I think every 6 years, isn't it? So he really is to be commended, because he's the one who's gone out on a limb and has nevertheless survived the voters in Orange County, nonetheless, which I think gives some indication that more and more people agree with your point of view. And I think it's an important philosophical point of view to stress. By the same token, when you're trying to persuade a reluctant public, which hasn't focused on this issue to the degree which most people here have, it probably is a mistake to lead with that argument. It's probably a mistake to suggest that these are beneficial substances that people ought to be able to use recreationally, even if you believe it. I think it's best to recognize that there are harmful effects which many people suffer from the use of narcotics, as they do from the use of nicotine and alcohol and so forth. And the approach which Marsha Rosenbaum's group has taken over the years is, how do you reduce the harm associated with the reality that people are going to use these substances? But I think there's a very significant segment of the population that agrees with your philosophical position. But I'd mute it if I were you and engaging in a political dialogue.
I didn't mean to have you walk away feeling that that was my point of view. My fourth question was just what you raised, namely, should people be able to put things into their bodies as they desired? As a philosophical matter, I believe in that entirely, and I think we have proved that as a political and legal matter, we are unable to keep that from happening. So the answer is, again, to hold people accountable for their conduct and let them decide themselves what to put into their bodies. That is what my answer would be.
This is for Judge Gray. Just a moment ago, you were talking about you're constrained to follow the law. Would you agree that jury nullification would be an element that could help change this situation and change it quickly?
Jury nullification is a very harmful concept and a very harmful idea. I know that a lot of my friends do not agree with that. I will stand on that proposition enormously. Okay, you and I agree pretty much with regard to the drug issues, and we're going in the wrong direction and the law should be changed and everything else. But you can use jury nullification in any way you want. You can use it to justify lynching and slavery. You can use it to justify unequal rights for women or anything else. There is no difference. If we get into that where we can instruct a jury that they don't have to follow the law, which, by the way, they do have the ability not to follow the law, they are just not instructed of that ability. There's a difference there, and that's a safeguard that I will also stand for. But if we instruct the jury that they do not have to follow the law, then we can very easily in our country end up with anarchy. The best way of getting a bad law changed is to enforce it, not to ignore it. And hopefully we, by enforcing these laws, are calling people's attention to it enough that these harmful laws will be changed. But otherwise, I think this is a very dangerous concept.
with the lady right now.
I thought there was a movement to do some reform to the Rockefeller drug laws. The mandatory minimum sentences under which people are just being incarcerated for absolutely ridiculous periods of time. Am I mistaken in that respect, or is there some movement?
No. Well, Governor Pataki in New York was taking the stand on this, and there was some progress being made. Not nearly enough, and the Rockefeller drug laws, maybe Marcia, you know more about it than I do, but it's my understanding that the Rockefeller drug laws are still in effect, but there is a movement, as you say, to reduce them. They are enormously harmful. They have done just hideous things that we have every right to be very displeased about, but so far, in my understanding, they still are in effect. Well, let me tell you this. Are you aware, folks? We in California have something like six times more people incarcerated this minute on a three strikes violation for marijuana offenses than robbery, rape, and murder combined. So let's not talk about New York. Let's talk about California. This is a hideous thing.
If the war on drugs falls, and we develop a policy such that drugs are controlled and legalized and taxed by the federal government, how much money, has anyone calculated how much money the federal government would make taxing the legalized, controlled use of drugs that could then be used to do research on the medical aspects of drugs and treatment of people rather than incarcerating them?
I don't know, Jim, of a specific figure that anyone has come up with, but I can't think of anything more encouraging. If you're concerned about the problems associated with heroin, cocaine, marijuana, whatever it is, methamphetamines, to put the sale, the distribution, the promotion, the advertising of these products in the hands of the people who run the Department of Motor Vehicles. Or the Internal Revenue Service. This, I think, is a major solution to a problem in the same way that in many states, in the wake of repeal, many states adopted programs in which the state ran the liquor stores. Pennsylvania, I think, still has state liquor stores. And it is one of the possibilities that Judge Gray alluded to in his comments, in which he suggested what we ought to move toward is a more federalist approach to drug policy, in which states and localities were given the authority to experiment with different means of distribution and different ways of addressing the problem. And of course, what would happen is what happened with alcohol in the wake of repeal. There would be a checkerboard of different schemes around the country, one of which would be putting the distribution of these products in the hands of people who just don't know how to sell anything.
By the way, two things I might add to that is we should keep in mind the old adage of the unholy alliance of the so-called Baptist and bootlegger, who were big advocates of prohibition. And Vaughn had mentioned different interest groups that are behind the continuation and expansion of all these policies. So you've got to be careful about tax policies, especially when you realize that the Harrison Act that Vaughn mentioned when it first started as a tax on opiates. It was an excise tax. And when that excise tax was implemented, it created a black market. The black market led to violence. People were upset about the violence. They blamed it on the drugs. And they banned the drugs, that led to more violence, and we're here today. Right there.
Judge Gray, I'm a public defender for 22 years, and as you know, we have a new proposition in California, Prop 36. I've written a couple articles on it. One of them in the Daily Journal headlined the 4th of September, "Public Defenders Should Cripple the War on Drugs." And as you know, Prop 36 provides first time in American jurisprudence, as far as I know, that you can go to trial on a felony case, a felony possession of drug charges, and upon conviction, the worst you can get is drug treatment. There are some exceptions, three-strike cases where people violate, but I have tried to enlist public defenders who will represent 95% of all defendants charged under Prop 36 to clog the courts, to try every Prop 36 case in order to make the war on drugs too damn expensive to continue. But public defenders, and I'm talking at the administrative level, are afraid to do that. They're afraid to rock the boat. My boss wrote an article in opposition to my position because he says I would be denying people treatment. Well, I tell you this, upon acquittal, people are still entitled to get into treatment and it would be self-initiated. We need the leadership of the bench to encourage public defenders to try every one of these Prop 36 cases, the ones that I have denoted no-risk cases. And I want to know what your thoughts are on that.
That is not going to happen. It is inappropriate, I think, for a judge to recommend to public defenders to do anything. It is inappropriate for a judge to recommend prosecutors to do anything. We do have a separation of powers. It is clear, everybody in the criminal justice system knows this, that if the defendants were all of a sudden decide all to go to trial, you're right, we couldn't get anything done because we rely upon the fact that something like 95% of all of the cases will end up in a plea one way or the other. But you have to understand, we are judges, we are neutral, and we are required to uphold the law. It is inappropriate for judges to talk about numbers of areas. I didn't know before I had my press conference back in April the 8th of 1992 whether I would be able to keep my judicial scalp by talking about this thing publicly because it might have been unethical. There was a group that I called, fellow judges who were there to give advice when we had ethical dilemmas. And I spent an hour and a half over lunch talking in a conference call with five other judges who were on this committee. And they basically, before I did this, they ended up splitting. That's what happens with judges. Two of them said, don't do it. This is an ethical violation. The other two said, I think it's probably okay. And the fifth one couldn't make up his mind. So, but judge, you're holding too much power up for judges. Judges should be quiet on that issue, as far as I'm concerned, and just adjudicate the issues presented to them.
So, the gentleman in the back has had his hand up for quite a while, right in the corner.
I'm wondering if you've seen any movement in corporate America, specifically the pharmaceutical companies, towards supporting legalization, mostly for the profit involved with the production and sale.
Actually, yes, not pharmaceutical companies. I suggested several years ago, 10 years or so ago, to a friend of mine who at that time worked for Philip Morris, that Philip Morris ought to get in the marijuana business. It seems to me like putting the state into the drug business, it would be a great idea. You know where to reach Philip Morris. You know where to serve them with a subpoena. They're subject to regulation. They're subject to controls. Purity of their substances could be measured and so forth. Whatever else you want to say about Philip Morris, they're out there. They're public. They're responsible in this sense. And it would be a vast improvement to put the distribution of these substances in the hands of such entities. At the time I made that suggestion, he was, of course, horrified to think that a friend of his would think that a buddy was a drug dealer, a drug peddler. But I think the events of the past 8 or 10 years have not been lost on the tobacco companies. They're now admitting that they sell a harmful and addictive product, which isn't any different from the kinds of narcotics that are being sold. And so I do believe that perhaps in the not too distant future you may begin to see some folks at these entities realize that there is a role for them to play. And I think it would be, oddly enough, a constructive development. So
let me add something to this too. Maybe you haven't focused on this. My eyes were opened a little while ago. Are you aware that the cigarette and alcohol industries donate large monies to, for example, the Partnership for a Drug-Free America and all this sort of stuff, in order to reinforce the distinction between legal drugs on the one hand and illegal drugs on the other. Why? Because they don't want that competition. Now, you could go to Philip Morris or whatever, and it's a natural. Or you could go to the Northwest United States, too, where the timber industry is pretty much kaput. And they could raise hemp, and they could, read in my book, and I wouldn't legalize very much, meaning aspirin is a legalized drug. There's no age restrictions. It's the price is set by the free market. That's not what I want to do with cocaine, for example. But for hemp, do it. Simply get this into the commercial market and allow it to be fully legalized. And then we can reinstitute this entire industry. And it's stupid not to. But let's realize money talks in this thing. Money is very important.
This gentleman over here, Carl's had his hand up too.
So I'm wondering if you believe it would be possible for one of the federal government agencies in the phalanx in the drug war to unilaterally pull out of the drug war?
No.
The mic is on its way. You have referred to legalizing the drug and holding an individual responsible, but is that realistic? Just recently we saw the case, yes, please, Judge, we saw the case in Los Angeles where the jury awarded an obscene amount to a man that admittedly had smoked cigarettes for 40 years.
Well, first of all, please, no one leave this room believing that I have recommended that we legalize anything except hemp and needle exchange. I wouldn't legalize any of these drugs, although it would be far superior to what we're doing now, but there are better ways of doing it. Bring it under strictly regulated control. With regard to this cigarette stuff, first of all, I'm not an expert and I haven't followed any of this, but my understanding of these cigarette laws is not because people have been smoking cigarettes. They knew full well that they were harmful. They've known that for years. They have this warning label on them and everything else. The gravamen of those cigarette cases was that the cigarette companies, the manufacturers, jerry-rigged it, made it more addictive in order to get people hooked and continue to be hooked. So it wasn't because they were selling a natural product. It was because they were making it an unnatural product and then lied about it. So that was the basis for those suits. And otherwise, there are problems in life. The easier one to give me trouble with is, okay, if we were to have this program of regulated distribution for cocaine, for example, which I do advocate, strictly regulated controls, then what's to keep you from suing the federal government if, in fact, you go out and commit these problems? And that's just like the dram shop laws, for example, where if you are a bartender and somebody is noticeably impaired by alcohol, and you know that and give them further alcohol, you can be legally responsible. But if you go to a liquor store and buy a fifth of Jim Beam and then go outside and chug a lug and die, still the liquor owner is not responsible. So it just depends what the circumstances are, and that's what we'd be facing.
Just three more questions. The gentleman in glasses right there.
The United States government, since at least 1932, when Harry Anslinger was in charge of the drug war and in that incarnation, has had the opportunity to win its war. And as we've all noted tonight, they haven't done so. What is to prevent those of us who can write and those of us who can put together a program to put together a model set of regulations and laws and propose that for a 5-year period, the old laws be scrapped and a new set be tested to see if indeed our ideas are correct. While I don't suggest that this is the way that a political process would unfurl, I suggest that that's a way of engaging the public in the debate in a very productive manner.
Absolutely.
I think that's a very good suggestion. It's my suggestion is, if in my book, is to adopt the concept of federalism. That means get the federal government out of this, like happened when we finally repealed alcohol prohibition. That didn't say alcohol is hereby legal in all the states. That just said the federal government no longer gets to play in this except to help each state enforce its chosen laws. That's what we should do. And then, you, if you're in Delaware or Virginia or California, you can do what you think is right. What I think you suggest here is a phenomenally good idea to spark more discussion. I hope you do it. Please do. I'll respond.
What do you mean when you say strict regulated control?
What do I mean when I say strictly regulated control?
We have control. It works beautifully, doesn't it?
No matter what system anyone puts in with regard to this area, there are going to be some problems, hands down. No one can design a system that will not have problems. You want to reduce the problems, as we're talking about. In my view, you have the problems now. There are no controls whatsoever, like I talked about before, except those instituted by the mob with regard to these illegal drugs. At least with regard to alcohol and cigarettes, you have some age restrictions. They're increasingly enforced, and you have more accountability. You have licensing. You have quality control. So what, again, I'm saying is bring the drugs back under the law and try to then enforce you have some laws where today we have none. But you're still going to have some problems. How? Read my chapter on the regulated distribution.
You have to be 21 to
shoot. Yes.
Morphine?
Yes.
That's open drug. So
okay.
Let's face it, we decriminalize it.
Well, okay. He is bringing up different terms. I go to great pains in my book to define different terms. The regulated distribution is not the decriminalization. I don't have time to go into these things now. All of these terms mean something different. We're trying to reduce the harm that can and will be caused from the presence of these drugs. Regulated distribution brings them back under control. They're still going to be abused. There's still going to be problems. But I manifestly guarantee you there will be fewer problems under that system than what we have today.
Hi, I have a comment and a question. The comment, I work for an elected official locally who's done a lot of work on medical marijuana. And in regard to the 30 million people that you were discussing earlier, I live in a pretty basic middle-class neighborhood, and every time I mention the work I've done on medical marijuana, three-quarters of my neighbors say, oh, I smoke pot. Don't tell anybody. And none of the neighbors know that all of them are, you know, doing it. It's kind of funny. But my question is, what can we do? What sort of legislation can we introduce on a local level? We've been frustrated. All of the talk of the concepts and the theories are wonderful, but it seems that the federal government holds all the cards. And Congress, to get 435 votes or half of that, seems virtually impossible. What else can we do beyond 215, beyond Prop 36? How can we take it further?
Well, you can keep passing those local laws. Because sooner or later, as Judge Gray mentioned, the federal government has limited resources and the limited ability to go after non-compliance with federal statutes. And, of course, you have to comply with federal requirements, just as anybody else does who's subject to federal regulation. But the important point is the folks in Washington have ears. And when they hear that the City Council of Oakland has done this, that, or the other thing, or the City Council of Fremont, or Vallejo, or whatever it is, that is heard. That's heard loud and clear in the halls of Congress, and the message will sooner or later be heeded. So keep doing it, and even if it doesn't work this time, know that there is always tomorrow.
I think I would be remiss. We are all frustrated. We all want to be able to do something. Write your congressman, that helps. Write your city officials, your local elected officials, if you're in their district, that helps. But there's something else. The media is enormously powerful in this area. And if people want to do more, log in on a website, www.drugsense.org, www.drugsense.org, or the Media Awareness Project, the MAP program. It's the same thing. There, they have an absolutely wonderful program to hold the media accountable. If they make a misstatement, these folks jump on them and correct it. There are things that we can do. The media is very valuable. Let me leave you, because I guess that was the third question, and we probably need to wrap this up. I think that's what David is standing here for. There was a man who was talking, you know, and he said, you know, when my grandmother turned 75 years of age, she started walking 5 miles a day. Now she's 79 and we haven't the faintest idea where she is. And in the same way, back the way Judge Walker was talking in the 1800s and then in 1914 and the rest, for whatever reasons, all of which were having nothing to do with health and nothing to do with safety, but for whatever reason we passed these various laws of drug prohibition. And I suggest to you we haven't the faintest idea where these laws have taken us. It's time that we legitimize that discussion. It's time that we open our collective eyes to our options, and then we will realize where we are. We can do this, and in fact, it's our fault that we have perpetuated it so long. So let's get busy. Let's not just say, well, we've done our good deed for the night because we spent the evening together. We really can and must do more. So I appreciate the opportunity of being with you. Thank you, David, for the invitation. Thank you for being with us.
I want to especially thank both Judge Gray and Judge Walker for joining with us and making their wonderful presentations. I also want to thank Judge Gray especially for his book, which again I hope everyone will get a copy. And I want to especially also thank all of you for joining with us and making our event this evening so successful. Two small things I might leave with you, which is an extension of something that Judge Gray mentioned. By 1997, in the United States, state and local agencies reported that almost 700,000 marijuana arrests, of which 87% for possession, had occurred. In other words, in the U.S., someone is arrested for a marijuana offense every 45 seconds, and this total number of arrests for all murders, rapes, robberies, and aggravated assaults is almost exactly the same as the number of marijuana arrests. So the emphasis in our society is obviously greatly out of kilter. For those of you who don't have a copy of Judge Gray's book, there are copies upstairs. He's indicated to be delighted to autograph copies. For those of you who have not gotten your copy autographed, again, thank you for joining with us. We hope that you'll join with us at our next event. Good night.
David,
thank you so
very much.
Thank you,
Emily.
Pleasure to have you.